Okay, our next speaker is Aaron Wall. He's giving a Blackboard talk at UC on holographic cosmology and negative probability.
Yes. So I'm going to try to make a pretty out there claim today and say that in order to understand cosmology, we have to understand theories with negative probability. So I'm going to try to make that seem as natural as it can seem. Okay, so I want to talk about what would be an analog of the holographic principle in cosmology. And I want to do something that's sort of inspired by DSCFT, but a little bit different. I want a holographic theory that lives on at a single moment of time, on a Cauchy slice at finite time. I've wanted this in ADS-CFT without quite thinking about this in these terms as a way of explaining Ryu Takinagi for some time, but you can also discuss this in cosmology, so that's what I'm going to be doing now. So what I want to propose is an analogy between two things, one of which is the Hartle-Hawking state, which, as you know, is defined by if you make some path integral with a Euclidean metric in, I'm going to call it D plus one dimensions, and you specify certain boundary conditions, and you derive from doing the path integral a Hartle-Hawking wave function, which is a functional of this boundary metric. So if we're in the dimensions of our own universe, this would be a metric on a three-dimensional space. And I want to propose that this would be the same as the partition function of a local Euclidean field theory. Where it's Euclidean, because that's to match the signature of this boundary dimension. Now there's no four-dimensional piece. It's just there's the partition function of some theory, which is also a functional of the metric. Now, this theory is a gravitational theory. Like in ADS-CFT, holography maps a gravitational theory to a non-gravitational theory. So we need to interpret this as a non-gravitational theory, but in a non-gravitational theory, there's still the metric can still be regarded as a non-dynamical but arbitrary curved source, typically. So we're going to think of the metric in this way, is how we end up with a partition function of the metric. Yes?
So, as was explained in Juan's book, I was the editing paper later by Dan Melody, so when you go to compute arbitrary observables in this kind of framework, you have to integrate over that metric ultimately. So that sounds...
Yes, well, it depends on what you mean by observables. Another way to say it is that the thing you mean by an expectation value on this side of the duality is different from the thing you mean by an expectation value on this side.
Exactly.
Yes.
That's why you end up having to integrate over the metric.
That's right. That is ultimately a question of interpretation, but if we're just trying to look for the duality at this level, we don't necessarily have to think about it right away. Although, presumably, if we end up finding negative probabilities in this Euclidean field theory, that may be part of the key for why it's still physically okay on the cosmology side. That comes in at the level of interpretation. But I think I agree with your essential point. So what would this analogy look like? Well, so we can make we can make a sort of chart of parallels between the two sides. So on the Hartle-Hawking side, a natural quantity to consider is the AADM canonical momentum. So we define that by a linear combination of the extrinsic curvature, which is the same as a functional derivative of this, viewed as like a QM operator acting on the state psi. On this side of the duality, the Euclidean field theory side, there's an analogous quantity that is the stress energy tensor of this field theory, which is defined in basically the same way. Factors of twos are just conventions. What's a little disturbing is that the main difference between these two formulas is that this one has an imaginary sign in it, and this one does not. So that if you might already start to worry that if you're in a context where where this pi takes a definite value and is real, because this is a self-adjoint operator interpreted in quantum mechanics language, that would naturally correspond to a situation where the stress energy tensor is imaginary in this field theory. So that's perhaps the beginning of trouble, but if we don't worry about the I sign, then there's a pretty close parallel here between these things. Now, what else are we interested in the ADM side? We're interested in the constraint equations, primarily. So the constraint equations break up into the spatial diffeomorphism constraint, and that is defined as saying that the divergence of pi is zero. On this side, if we assume that the partition function is defined in a covariant way, this is automatic that we will also have that the stress energy tensor is conserved. So that's a match between both sides. Now, we also want a Hamiltonian constraint equation. The Hamiltonian constraint equation is the, in general relativity, it's the statement, it's something like not worrying too much about factors. It's something like this, where we have the spatial 3 curvature, we have a cosmological constant, and we have something quadratic in the extrinsic curvatures, and the trace piece comes in with an unexpected minus sign that's a bit peculiar, as if expansion had negative energy somehow. So this Hamiltonian constraint equation, so we naturally have on this side d plus 1 constraints. We also naturally have on this side of the dictionary d plus 1 constraints, but the 1 doesn't go quite so automatically. I think the right way to think about this is if this were a CFT, then the 1 constraint is the statement that the stress energy tensor equals the conformal anomaly, which, if we're actually in the dimension of our own universe, it's odd that d is 3, and this is actually 0. So we have the right number of constraints, but this one is the wrong constraint. But that's not so bad of a thing, because that was under the assumption that this field theory is a conformal field theory. And if I want for this dictionary to be defined at finite time in cosmology, as opposed to scribe plus, like people usually do DSCFT, then it ought not to be a CFT, because the conformal part of the metric is indeed a physical thing that is not a mirror gauge convention at finite time. So this theory should not be a just t equals zero. It should not be conformal. There should be also, in addition to the conformal anomaly term, therefore an explicit symmetry breaking term that comes from whatever, if we started with a CFT, it comes from whatever perturbation we wanted to add to the CFT that is non-conformal. Of course, the type of perturbation that we want to add to get a theory like this is by now well known. We will want something like we want something here that's quadratic in the stress energy tensor. So this is going to be this should be something quadratic in TAB. So it's like a TT bar deformation, except if D is greater than 2, we shouldn't call it TT bar. We should just call it T squared or something. This makes sense. We know in ADS-CFT, a TT bar deformation takes us to a finite value of the Z coordinate. If we were doing DS-CFT, it should take us to a finite value of the time coordinate. Now, there's another important thing here about the ADM formula. Yes?
So in TT bar, no locality is discussed extensively. So why do you say that thing is a local Euclidean field?
The question was, in TT bar, people discuss non-locality as being a thing, and I'm calling it a local field theory. So a couple points one could make. I think the way that TT bar really becomes non-local is when you truncate the spectrum to exclude the complex eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian. And I think in the way I'm thinking about it, I don't want to do that. Another point, though, is the non-locality is most obvious on the ADS-CFT side because it involves signals propagating faster through the interior of the bulk than they can go around. There's no obvious analog of that paradox when I'm taking this to be a Euclidean field there. And my third comment, I don't know which of these is the correct answer, or maybe all of them, but my third comment is when I say local field theory, I'm of course being a little blasé because we don't know how to define quantum gravity below the Planck scale. So you could, if you like, say this is actually a field theory with some sort of UV regulator. If you come along and give me a quantum gravity theory, maybe string theory or something, that defines things below the Planck scale, it could be that it smooths it out in such a way that it's a true continuum Euclidean field theory. But speaking, if I want to cover all the possible bases, I should allow for the possibility that this is really a regulated Euclidean field theory with some short distance cutoff. Right, so what else do we have here? A very important thing that makes the ADM formulation work is that the constraint equations close. What does this mean? Well, we can take the bracket of the Hamiltonian constraint with itself. This is the most non-trivial closure relation. The commutator of it with itself does not necessarily vanish because it's a function of the spatial position, so those arguments don't need to be identical with each other. And in particular, there can be a contact term, which in order to be anti-symmetric should actually involve the derivative of a delta function. And we can contract the derivative of that delta function with something, and what it turns out to be, if you study this, is it turns out to just be the diffeomorphism constraint. which of course also is something we're setting to zero. So the constraint equations close. There's a way in which Lorentz invariance is baked into this as well. So that's sort of an important automatic consequence. Now, if we're doing quantum gravity from scratch, this is actually a super hard thing. If we were instead a bunch of loop quantum gravity people, and I said, I've come up with some discretization of quantum gravity, and I have this analog, discrete analog of the constraint equation, people would go, oh, yeah, well, whatever, we've seen that. And if I said, and I can prove it closes, then people would go, oh, that's wonderful. That's amazing. We didn't know how to do that necessarily. So, the nice thing about this holographic way of thinking about it is I think the constraint closure happens automatically. And it corresponds to what, with only a slight abuse of or extension of notation, you might call a West-Zimino consistency condition. A slight extension of notation because we're no longer just in the situation where things are controlled by the anomaly. There's also the explicit term. But I think the point is, schematically, that if I start with a point in RG space that is a CFT, and if it has D plus 1 constraint equation, and then I flow by turning on some term, like a TT bar deformation, I don't think the number of constraint equations can discontinuously change. So things sort of automatically have to work. So this suggests, if you write down the right sort of field theory with the UV regulator, it somehow just is quantum gravity, and with Lorentz invariance baked in automatically, if you can just get this, this extra equation to look right, which it might even do in some generic sense in the right class of field theories. Now, there's two possible ways to proceed here. One strategy, how would we check this? How would we check to see if this hypothesis is true? The two obvious ways to check it, number one, is find the field theory. And ideally, it would not be defined by start with the CFT and flow with the TAB squared deformation, because we don't know how to define that non-perturbatively in N. There's still a quantum gravity problem there. Well, ideally, we'd find a way of defining this theory from scratch in such a way that it's just when you think of it in a Wilsonian sense, all possible terms appear in the various formulas with some coefficient, and the leading order terms beyond the conformal thing might plausibly look something like the Hamiltonian constraint. I'm not going to... one of the nice properties of TT bar in D equals 2 is that it is non-perturbatively well-defined. I'm talking about D greater than 2. Yes. It does work, I think. It's just that when you deform a CFT by an irrelevant operator, it doesn't necessarily give a non-perturbative definition of the field. We could think of it in an RG flow sense. I could say I could flow to an IR fixed point. I could imagine it's not really an IR fixed point because there's also this Einstein-Hilbert term that's relevant. But let's ignore this Einstein-Hilbert term. If I think about flowing in a Wilsonian sense to a fixed point, I can look at what are the deviations from the CFT and the IR, and it could be that the leading order deformations are some sort of irrelevant deformation. To define that in a non-perturbative fashion, what I'd really want to do is define a different theory in the UV and show that it flows to that. Anyway, so that's one possible approach. And I'm not, that's not the rest of this talk. Another possible approach, how else could we check it? The other possible approach is an axiomatic approach. It looks like I, oh yeah, okay, I can still. So in the axiomatic approach, you would say, look at the Hartle-Hawking state. Does it obey the axioms of a standard Euclidean field theory, well-defined in curved space-time and some other conceptually tricky things? If it does, if it obeys the axioms of Euclidean field theory, then you're forced to agree that it is a genuine Euclidean field theory, unless you want to say we were missing an axiom. And then you should tell me what the axiom is. So because of that, I started looking at the, again, at the Osterwalder-Schrader axioms of Euclidean field theory. They defined it for flat space-time, but it gives a start. You can certainly expand go to the regime where the Hartle-Hawking state is expanded around flat space-time. In fact, that our own universe is flat at one moment of time, plus small corrections. So if you look at the Osterwalder-Schrader axioms, there's a bunch of axioms. There's analyticity. These are axioms defined for the endpoint functions. So you take that as the basic object. You want analyticity, you want Euclidean group symmetry, you want permutation symmetry, you want cluster decomposition, and the all-important reflection positivity. Now, I'm not going to go into these as much detail as last time I gave this talk because I have less time. I will say the fact that this is a regulated field theory, potentially, so that we don't understand how things work below the Planck scale, could lead to a sort of trivial or stupid way in which this doesn't satisfy these axioms. I propose to not think about that at the moment and just think about endpoint functions that are much bigger than the Planck scale. There's a much more fundamental issue here. If you sort of squint at things, I don't claim to have proofs for all of these, but if you squint, it looks like the Hartle-Hawking state really ought to, more or less at large scales, obey all of these axioms if you ignore the Planck scale issue. The one that does not seem to obey is reflection positivity. Yes. So you probably mostly all know what reflection positivity is, but I'll just say what it is anyway. You have some sum over endpoint functions on the right-hand side of some plane. Yes?
In talking about these endpoint functions, now you're really thinking of the correlation function that derivatives on psi. Are you still doing this integral on the metric?
That's right. Sorry, are we still doing the integral?
Referring to Eva's question.
He's asking Eva's question.
I am talking about the endpoint functions interpreted in the field theory sense, even though we're doing it with the Hartle-Hawking wave function. That means differentiation of the wave function with respect to the metric around a flat background.
Okay, so I understand that ultimately you agree you have to do the integral, but stopping short of doing the integral, what if you did Poincaré slices, or not Poincaré, but flat slices of the sitter? And the reason I say that is because that's the case that David was alluding to, which would be completely well-defined, if I understand correctly. That would be the analog of flat space slicing of ADS.
Sorry, do you have a more detailed question than what if?
No, it's not a what if.
What if we do that, then what? What is your question about what would happen if we do that?
You were stressing that you couldn't define it, and I'm saying in this case you can.
Well, only in perturbation theory, though, right?
We're
just 5 minutes from the end of the formal talk, so let's get to that.
Yeah, maybe we can have the Q&A during the Q&A. So what you do is you take these endpoint functions, you reflect them across the plane. I'm assuming they're self-adjoint, otherwise you have to take the adjoints of them. You take the same sum, but reflected, that you had on the other side. And this whole thing is supposed to be greater than or equal to zero. So that is reflection positivity. Actually, I think there's another axiom which Osterwalder and Schrader forgot, but that we probably actually want, which is the existence of a stress energy tensor, which obviously this is going to satisfy because that's how we were thinking about it originally. If you don't include this axiom, then I'm pretty sure just like a well-defined three-dimensional field theory, but you only look at endpoint functions on like a two-dimensional plane would technically still obey the axioms, but that's not what we mean by holography. So you may want to add this too. Anyway, this thing is going to turn out to be false for the Hartle-Hawking wave function, and it's easiest to show with, if you look at the, actually not the flat slice thing, but the compact version of this thing, where the Hartle, I could just do Hartle-Hawking in mini superspace and make it a function of the radius, and there's a critical radius that's the de Sitter radius, and we have an exponential wave function on one side, and there's a sort of airy-like behavior where it's oscillatory on the other side, and oscillating things are not everywhere positive. Done. So this thing does not look like a standard reflection positive field theory. But when I was looking at the Osterwalder-Schrader paper, I realized something. There's something very beautiful about their construction, which is they don't assume the existence of a Hilbert space, they construct it. What they do is they actually define the space of possible sums over these endpoint functions. You can make it into a vector space, and that vector space automatically has a non-negative inner product by this construction here. There's a bunch of zero vectors. There ought to be, if there's any relations among endpoint functions at all, we can then mod out by the zero vectors, and we end up with defining a Hilbert space. Well, what I realized is you have, in some sense, no choice but this construction to be available. So if we're now doing the Hartle-Hawking state, then I think there, again, not a statement at the rigorous level. It probably can be made more rigorous. But I believe if you have the Hartle-Hawking state, there's nothing stopping us from doing the same construction. We will just end up with a Hilbert space that we shouldn't call a Hilbert space because it has negative norm states. But what I realized is these vector spaces with an indefinite inner product associated with codimension 2 surfaces are going to be there whether you want them to be there or not. And it looks very holographic because it's something a lot like a Hilbert space that we're associating with a one-dimension, dimension 1 lower surfaces, but these indefinite things are there. So we have to find a way to interpret them and live with them. Now, obviously, at the end of the day, when we interpret probabilities correctly, according to some description, the negative probabilities should go away. But I think a little bit that this is a little bit like the how Schrodinger invented the Klein-Gordon equation first. He actually invented that before the non-relativistic Schrodinger equation, but he saw the negative frequencies. He said, this is absurd. It has negative probabilities. So he didn't publish that and failed to be the discoverer of the Klein-Gordon equation. And it was only decades later that people really understood how properly you get rid of the negative probabilities. So he should have published anyway. But, of course, it's not so bad because the non-relativistic Schrodinger equation was also an important discovery. So it's just as well he went somewhere else. But what I'm saying is one shouldn't give up on these things too early. I believe that we should be expanding our space of field theories to cover the space of non-reflection positive field theories, and when we do so, we will find that this is inevitable if we want to understand actually not just cosmology, but I think even ADS-CFT in Lorentzian signature. Yeah, so that's my point. I think Gary was first. Okay.
So I think if you just drop reflection positivity, then another thing you generally drop is the norm is not preserved. Whereas in this case, you probably want the norm to be preserved under time evolution. So maybe you want to add another, have a weaker axiom if you're going to drop reflection positivity.
The norm is not preserved. You mean under a Lorentzian evolution?
Yeah.
Right, so that there is a important question when we're dropping this, what are we still keeping? And we do still want to keep some things, because if we want, for example, unitarity in the cosmology side, we want the first approach to saying what we want is to say we want a real Hamiltonian, but that's the wrong way to say it, because the Hamiltonian is, of course, zero, which is always real. We could, however, say, well, we do want the formula for this Hamiltonian constraint, but we at least want the terms to come in with the right relative phase. We don't want some funny I signs in there. And so it's an interesting question, what restricted class of non-reflection positive theories should we look at? As for norm preservation, I think there are some situations where you can still get that, but maybe I'd need to discuss that offline.
Okay, so I had, we've been hearing a lot about topology change in this conference and baby universes.
Unfortunately, I was planning to be on Monday, but life intervened. So you'll have to summarize anything that's important to your question.
Well, the question is, how do you describe topology change, a baby universe breaking off or joining in if your dual theory is just the Euclidean quantum field theory on a particular single, say, connected manifold?
It's not. No, so what quantum gravity really is in this way of looking at it is not defined on just one possible background metric. You have to think about non-gravitational field theory defined on all possible background metrics. That's what's really, I think, quantum gravity. So many non-gravitational field theories are dual to a single, maybe there is only one quantum gravity theory, because whatever sources you write down, interpret in a holographic way, we think of them as fields, as instead of as fundamentally fixed quantities.
And are there interactions between the Euclidean field theories on the different connected components?
Oh, sorry, so you mean, you're talking about different, yeah. So, no, there are not, and, right, I see the thrust of your question. So, this would suggest various things. I mean, it would suggest all sorts of crazy things, like if a black hole forms a baby universe and then evaporates entirely, that somehow the information is all still there in this original universe, you know. But nobody here would take that seriously, so.
So your last sentence said this negative probabilities appear in ADS-CFT. Could you amplify on that?
Right, right. So I think the critical point here is not the sign of the cosmological constant. It's not about DS versus ADS. It's about the fact that I wanted a holographic theory of a Cauchy slice in a Lorentzian signature spacetime. So the I think if I were in ADS-CFT and I wanted to pull this, write the same sort of holographic model down, which is not the same as the usual way of thinking about ADS-CFT, because the usual way of thinking about ADS-CFT, the non-gravitational field theory lives at spatial infinity. If I instead wanted to think about the non-gravitational field theory living on a Cauchy slice of ADS, that and I'm doing it in Lorentzian signature, as well, that's the term Cauchy slice, then that is, I think, when we get non-reflection positivity, even in the ADS signature. In fact, you can see in situations where you transition between a Euclidean signature phase and a Lorentzian signature phase, that's at this transition that you start getting non-reflection positivity. So it's not about the sign of the cosmological constant. It's about the fact that we need to understand Lorentzian signature quantum gravity.
So I have a little confusion. So you said you can check these axioms, the first four that are satisfied, based on the left-hand side definition that you gave, but presumably you're only doing some path integral over metrics and not some UV complete calculation of the Hartle-Hawking wave function. So my question
is... That's right, you have to check it semi-classically, and then there's some things you can't do, like Planck scale separation, but go on.
So by checking, you mean you were just doing it in the semi-classical approximation, that you're checking these axioms with the psi HH computed just as a path integral over metrics.
That's correct. Okay.
So in the old days of DSCFT, everyone would have said that the dual CFT was non-unitary, for example, because they're operator dimensions that are complex. So I guess that statement seems not surprising, but what I want to comment was, so you said that approach one is kind of hard, but back in those days, there was even an example from Tom and Dio.
Yeah,
and
I know about this example.
Yeah, so can you comment on to what extent that satisfies the axioms you like or somehow tells you what additional constraints might be there?
I believe it's the example isn't the example basically a free field day with the wrong spin statistics relation.
I believe
that a scalar fermion will satisfy everything here except reflection positivity.
Yeah, but maybe it'll break it in the right way, right? Because there should be some rules about how it's broken.
Right, there should be right. So there's probably some other sort of positivity that like cosmological positivity or something that is the right condition to impose and might even be just as restrictive as reflection positivity, but it's not the same condition.
So that theory is PT symmetric, which is similar to reflection positivity with an extra operator.
I have a comment about the reflection positivity. So the reason it's violated is because if you think about flat space and a small deformation, the wave function goes like e to the minus, it's a Gaussian in the small deformation. So when you take second derivatives, you get something negative.
Right.
So the reflection positivity is really a requirement for the wave functional to be well-defined. But this also highlights the fact that the inner product we are taking is not the one that Torsten Wölder-Schadr had. The inner product we are taking of wave functions is to take two copies and integrate, sort of what Eva was saying. And if you do that in that context, you get something well-defined. So you get positive probabilities and so on, up to, well, the issue of taking the Klein-Gordon norm and so on, which doesn't arise in perturbation theory, for example.
I agree with all that. I do think maybe there's still a need for some trick to get rid of the negative probabilities, because you might have thought at the end of the day that we want to define cosmology using some sort of holographic screen. And if we think about cosmology as ultimately, there's this way of thinking about it doesn't give me I only have one state if I don't have a boundary of space. If I have a boundary of space, then I have what I might like to be a Hilbert space, but there are negative norm states. So if, that is, one might be tempted to say, as we often say in ADS-CFT, that if the quantum gravity theory isn't well-defined, we turn to the other theory to define what we really mean by the Hilbert space and so on, non-perturbative. If we ultimately take this strategy, then it's not going to be obvious how to purge the negative probabilities. But there might be a way to do it. It might be something as simple as there just needs to be the right boundary conditions on the holographic screen, or you might need to throw in some extra minus one to some projection operator or something.
Since the stress tensor is imaginary, would you be not more natural to expect it's a Lorentzian evolution, so around the spatial size? So maybe it's not refraction positivity, but it's like respect Lorentzian correlators.
Sorry, can you say that again?
You talk about the issue of a refraction positivity, but the stress tensor you mentioned is imaginary. So energy is imaginary. So what we more nature to expect is not e to the minus beta h, but e to the I ht, and the correlators with respect to the Lorentzian evolution around the spatial direction.
Well, I mean, certainly we transition between quantum field theory and statistical field theory all the time, and we don't usually think of that as making the stress tensor imaginary. I should say, saying the stress tensor is imaginary is a bit of a subtle statement, because you can have superpositions of different values. You can, you know, the Hartle-Hawking state is actually real, because of the superposition of the expanding and contracting things. So technically, the derivatives are never imaginary, but if you start thinking about the squares, then the square of the thing is negative. So it's, yeah.
So I want to ask a different question, which is that in string theory, there is a very clear structural constraint, which is the metastability of de Sitter and the fact that it ultimately decays to some more general FRW rolling scalar. So one might expect that the theory that describes the de Sitter to a very, very good approximation for an exponentially long time, you know, isn't ultimately complete. And I'm with you that we should work at finite times, and it's like normal physics, we can do that without knowing the ultimate theory. So I think all the things you said about that level of approximation are appropriate, but it might be that this theory isn't complete. Is that possible?
Well, if quantum gravity is somehow the space of all non-gravitational field theories, then you've sort of completed it by definition. So it includes all of the vacuum. I don't see right away, if we're doing it at finite time, why we even care if it's metastable or not.
Yeah. One thing is that you mentioned the holographic screen. At least naively, holographic screen is something like space-like. It just projects onto space-like, and then you do the time evolution. So it's not that different from ADS-CFT. But if this succeeds, it looks like time evolution is not there, right? You have a wave function of the universe or multiverse or whatever, everything. So time evolution must come from relationally in the usual way of do it. You just have to...
Time evolution is like a tautology that says it's the space of all equations that general partition functions obey. And so that tautology is what we should be looking for to explain the Hamiltonian constraint.
Yes, so I'm saying that...
Space at a later moment of time is another more complicated way to get the same partition function. Yeah.
So I'm saying that the approach seems to be quite different. For example, for topology change, you have to put excitation like clock, and you see the correlation between the hands of the clock and then the metric and then topology and those things. So you don't evolve this one, right? I mean, this is really like...
When I said holographic screen, I was really thinking a slice of a holographic screen at one moment of time.
Yeah, that's very different. Then you have to time it all.
I just wanted to comment that first, there's nothing very exotic about non-reflection positive Euclidean CFTs, right? People study them all the time,
and
they just don't have probabilistic interpretation. I mean, the norm doesn't have probabilistic interpretation. So I'm very confused why you want to give some probabilistic interpretation to this norm. I think that we understand, sort of, at least in perturbation theory, what are the probabilities in this cosmological setup, like one, and what is unitarity? One is the thing that Juan and Eva were mentioning, then even at the level just of the wave function, there is, say, things that Nima is thinking about, right? We know some constraints that unitary bulk evolution imposes on this wave function. It has nothing to do with this norm, it has to do with some discontinuities of these correlators, right? For example, there is a limit of this object that gives us the flat space S matrix of the same theory in the bulk, and that should be unitary in the usual form.
But we don't live in that limit, we live in actual cosmology.
Yeah, but this leaves...
I don't think it should be confusing why I want a probability interpretation for a theory describing the actual universe.
No, I think it's confusing.
it's confusing how and why whether we get it, but it shouldn't be confusing why I, Aaron Wall, want there to be a probability interpretation for a theory describing the real
universe. But I didn't say that we don't want probability interpretation. It's not obvious to me why you think it has to do anything with this norm.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
cares if this funny Euclidean thing has a, this Oscar Wilde-Schrader one is positive?
Well, that norm is actually quite ambiguous when you go beyond perturbation theory, because there's you have to put a measure.
No, I know. I mean, I agree. It's confusing. So there's, but that's not going to turn it into this one, right? I mean,
right. Well, I think I already answered this question. You might not like my answer, but it's at least a possibility that we'll have to ultimately define the quantum gravity theory via this other theory. It may not be the only way forward.
We're going to have to stop there for the coffee break. Thank Aaron again.